Well, welcome everyone. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Professor Robin Silberglide. I direct the creative writing program here. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Matthew Gavin Frank, who braved the snow for us and might be trapped in East Lansing for a while. And unable to get back to Marquette. So this event really is a two for one. So it is both an installation in the Michigan Writers Series, which is something organized out of the main library here, and all the events by Michigan Writers are recorded and available for streaming if you go to the library catalog, actually. So at some point you can listen to this talk again if you're so inclined. And it is also a moment to announce the winners of our undergraduate creative writing awards. And we've got winners in six different categories this evening. He'll be acknowledged by Matt Frank. So a couple quick thank yous. First of all, Matt, thank you for braving the weather and coming down here. It's quite a drive, I know. Thanks also to co-sponsors for this event, Michael Rodriguez from the library, and Anita Skeen and Lori Hollinger from the Center for Poetry at Residential College in Arts and Humanities, and certainly my colleagues in the Department of English who really make this event possible. I have to acknowledge two people who I don't think are here this evening, but they do a lot of the work behind the scenes. So Tyler Zamora, who is an undergraduate intern working with me, who managed all the electronic submissions so miraculously. He did a fantastic job. And also Sue Plesko, who is our office manager in the department, who makes travel arrangements and things possible. I think that's all I have to say at this point. So I'm going to turn things over to Professor Marsha Aldrich, who will introduce Matt Frank. Thanks.
Good. Can I drink your water? Most writers are introduced by recounting their academic credentials, followed by their awards and publications, and give the impression that the writer went directly from one academic program to another, with precious else intervening in their life's trajectory. Matt's biography charts a different course. Matt left his home in Chicago at the age of 17 and embarked on a vagabond lifestyle that led to his working in the restaurant industry. He ran a tiny breakfast joint in Juneau, Alaska, worked illegally on a Barola wine harvest, an experience he harvested for his book, Barola. Worked on a medical marijuana farm in Northern Carolina, which again resulted in a book, Pot Farm. Designed degustation menus for Julia Roberts' private parties in New Mexico, which I'm going to ask him to tell me about what those are. Served as a sommelier on the catalog and on a catalog of interesting jobs until he went back to school, a sort of dull outcome, earning his MFA in both poetry and creative nonfiction from Arizona State University. Matt is a writer who immerses himself in different worlds, especially food worlds, becoming an insider, if only temporarily. Now he teaches in the English department at Northern Michigan University, where he is the nonfiction and hybrid editor of the literary journal Passages North. His writing appears in too many journals to name and is anthologized in the best travel writing, best food writing, and the best of brevity. His nonfiction books include the aforementioned Barola in 210, Pot Farm 212, Preparing the Ghost, an essay concerning the giant squid and its first photographer, and his just released The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food, from which he will be reading tonight. In one of the 50 essays in The Mad Feast, he considers the pasty and Michigan, locating the dish in the region's history of mining and drowning in Lake Superior. He writes, "In the pasty is an eating toward, a sinking to the bottom of food. Eating mimics drowning. In the pasty, a baked pastry shell, half of which includes a savory dinner of stewed meat and root vegetable, half of which includes dessert, is difficulty breathing, eyes adjusting to the mine shaft dark and to the daylight, anticipation, harbinger, a whole new world beyond the chuck and the rutabaga, apples and cinnamon, an eating toward and an eating toward sweetness. This is food writing like I've never encountered, so imaginative as to make me think I knew nothing of the pasty before I read it. Please welcome Matt Frank. Thank you.
Am I decently mic'd? Okay, all right. I don't usually wear these. I think I've worn one once. Thank you so much, Robin. Thank you so much, Marcia, for having me here. Thank you all for coming out. I want to begin with a confession before I read. How to frame this? Like this. I feel as if my physical downfall, perhaps even my psychological downfall, you all, will result from the fact that when traveling overseas, when traveling abroad, I have absolutely no resolve when it comes to saying no to certain foods that I should not be eating and certain beverages that I should not be drinking. For example, my wife and I spend a lot of time in Oaxaca, Mexico. We want to retire there one day, many, many, many years from now. And whenever I'm traveling abroad, I can't say no to street food. I love eating street food. I feel as if it's, you know, perhaps, you know, some misguided, easy way to expose myself to a microcosm of a culture of which I'm clearly not a part when I'm traveling. And it allows me to take a bit of it inside me. And so I can't say no. I adore street food, and I adore the act of buying it and eating it, you know, when I'm traveling. In Oaxaca, Luisa and I came upon this outdoor taco stand, this outdoor taco stall the last time we were there. And it was fronted by this hunchbacked old Zapotec woman who came up to about here on me. She had a mound of blue corn masa dough next to her. And when folks would come up and order a taco, she would pinch off you know, a small round of the masa dough, flatten it between her palms, and toast it on the outdoor comal, this outdoor griddle, and then fill it with one of nine fillings that were detailed on this downturned chalkboard easel. That excited me. I wanted to eat one of those fresh tortillas. I speak a little bit of Spanish. My Spanish is imperfect. And I understood eight of the nine fillings that were detailed on this downturned chalkboard easel and embodying the personality trait for which my wife regularly chastises me. I chose the ninth. Maybe you know what this is. If so, don't say anything. Sesos. I ordered a taco de sesos. The hunchbacked old Zapotec woman, after I intoned un taco de sesos, por favor, rounded her comal and came right up to me. We were nearly touching. And she looked up at me with this intense, if bemused, look in her eyes and said, "Sesos? Sirioso." She called me Sirius. That's not something I'm often called. And that also excited me. I felt born anew. I felt as if she taught me something about myself. I never would have self-applied that adjective. And I felt substantial as a result, filled out, tough to knock over, which I'm also not. Super heroic even. And so I said, see, yes, I am serious. And so she retrieves from beneath her outdoor komal a white plastic bucket, and inexplicably, the label on the bucket is printed in both Spanish and English. While my Spanish is imperfect, I feel as if I have a decent handle on English, and so I understood the translation, and sesos, you all, are pork brains, pig brains. That made me nervous. I had never eaten the brain of a pig before. And moreover, I'd never eaten the brain of a pig as street food. What made me even more nervous is that my wife, who is not from the US, in her first language, there's a phrase that when directly translated into English goes something like this. If you eat the brain of a pig, you will see the wind blow, which means you will go crazy. You will trip off into the recesses of your own brain, never to return, hence psychological downfall. So that made me nervous, too. And so the hunchbacked old Zapotec woman ripped the lid of the pork brains off of the tub and plunged her hand into it and came up with a fistful of gray matter, scattered it over the outdoor komal where the chunks proceeded to pop and hiss and steam. Soon they were finished, and she made for me one of these incredibly, you know, and initially seductive tortillas. And with a spatula about as long as my forearm, kind of ladled the brains into said tortilla, topped it with a little bit of pickled onion, pickled radish, little lettuce, little tomato, a thin guacamole, and salsas, both verde and rojo. And she handed it to me and rounds the komal again and just gets in my face. And she passes it to me and I take it. And she doesn't leave. She keeps looking at me, waiting for me to take a bite. And I think she nods and actually makes that go ahead noise. And so there's no way out. And so I do, and I take a bite. And you all, it was awful. I wish I could say it was amazing. I wish I could say, you know, my expectations were subverted, but they weren't. The pig brain tasted precisely organic, meaning like an organ. Iron rich and metallic. And so I took that bite and nodded tight-lipped, and she seemed satisfied with that and went back and took somebody else's order. And I scurried up the street, and I feel terrible about this. I actually scooped the brain into a trash can. I did eat the tortilla, though, in spite of the fact that it was soaked with brain a bit. I hate wasting food. I spent about 18 years of my occupational life in restaurant kitchens and saw so much food waste. And so I hate wasting food, so it killed me to throw the brain away, but I just couldn't do it. That night, I had this dream. I'll read something in a minute. I promise. We go to Oaxaca, Mexico a lot, and we stay at this flat at Hotel Las Golondrinas, which means the swallows. I'm obsessed with swallows, the birds. I love them. I could rattle off a bunch of swallow facts, but in the interest of speeding things along. So I had this dream. I was in a field of tall grass, a meadow, I think. The sky was this cracking blue, not a cloud in it. The sun was out, and the temperature was downright balmy, dream balmy, balmy in a way that it isn't in waking life. And I appreciated that in the dream as I was on all fours in this field of tall grass, lowing to the earth with my nose as if a cow. It was incredibly peaceful, incredibly meditative. This sense of calm just suffused this dream until I decided to look up from the chill of the earth toward the horizon, and I saw on the horizon this pair of disembodied blue jeans legs. And they started walking toward me, these legs, closing the distance between horizon and me on all fours in this field of tall grass, cutting through the grass as if it were canebrake. With each step that these legs took, the temperature dropped about 5 degrees, and clouds began to knit together in the sky. And this sense of peace was very quickly replaced by one of menace. And soon, these legs were upon me. And I looked up from my perspective down there on the earth. And they sprouted a torso, and arms, and a head, and it became the stereotypical farmer figure with a pot belly in overalls and a straw hat. And he was wielding an axe. And he took one final step and brought the axe down, thwack, and split my skull, buried the blade right between my eyes. And I remember looking up in dream and seeing the axe handle angling outward into the sky where the clouds now were roiling. And I woke up screaming, as I tend to do. I can't believe I admitted that to a room full of people. My wife, who was previously snoring demurely beside me, woke up. And she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Where am I? Where am I?" And she said, "Baby, it's okay. We're in Oaxaca, Mexico, in Hotel Las Golondrinas." And I calmed down and I told her about the dream in the middle of the night. And we turned on our nightstand lamps. She's so generous. She indulged me in this conversation in the middle of the night, and she helped me make sense of it. And she allowed me to come to realize that in dream, I was anointed with the vision of that poor pig who died for my taco. I think I was guilty about it. I'm Matt Frank, you all. I'm going to read about food now. My first restaurant job was in a fast food chicken shack on the outskirts of Chicago when I was 11 years old. I was washing dishes. And so, as I mentioned, I stayed in and on and off for about 18 years. And so I've been thinking for a while about food, working with it. I've long been obsessed with it, dreaming about it, manipulating it, physically touching food, manipulating texture, temperature in things. And writing about it. The Mad Feast is a collection of 50 essays, one for each of the US states, each essay beginning with a foodstuff typical of said US state, and then digressing in oftentimes cockeyed ways from there, in an effort to grapple toward perhaps an illusory answer to the question as to why we eat, what we eat, where we eat it. I'm not going to read the pasty essay. I can't read the Michigan essay in Michigan. It's just too intimate. It feels too weird. But I'll read something Upper Midwestern, about something Upper Midwestern. I'll read the Minnesota essay. It's not quite Michigan. The dish that I chose for Minnesota was a hot dish. I'm guessing some of you might know what that is. If you don't, essentially, it's a catch-all casserole birthed in desperation. This is called the hot dish muddies the water, or those poor drowned. This is desperation, imagination, blowing bubbles into our cream of mushroom soup, not because we're feeling playful, but because in this cold, the snow fine is dust, it hurts to take air in. So we extend our exhales as long as we can, pretend that history and nostalgia are the same thing. This has everything to do with a tater tot crust as blanket in our hot dish, as some golden brown storm cloud cresting the baking pan, yanked from failing oven after failing oven in the church basements of Arrowhead, along the shores of Lake Superior, in International Falls, Minneapolis, St. Paul. This winter has depth, layers. This is winter as casserole, as the French word for saucepan. This is a season so freezing, it doubles back on itself and simmers. Sometimes, our bodies get so cold, they burn. Sometimes, we overflow the pan's lip, stiffen on the element. Sometimes, like the drowned with ice in their lungs, we stick to the bottom. In this weather, unlike the tater tots in our hot dish, we don't golden, but redden. Uncle talks of his years harvesting sugar beets, raising turkeys in Todd County, now the poorest goddamn county in the state, he says, before he was forced by General Mills, Cargill, Hormel, and Schwann to retire. These same companies now producing the processed hamburger and frozen string beans and potato buds we heap into our hot dish, used to feed congregations. He lost so much of his body to the cold and to the thresher, he has a single finger left. The important one, he says, as he struggles to wrap it like a boa over the stem of his fork, sink it into the hottest middle part, beneath the tater tots. According to Hallie Herron's article, Heating Up the Heartland, Minnesota's signature hot dish combines heartiness, great taste, and adaptability. Our state casserole retains no official recipe or rules beyond economic and gustatory desperation. As such, we have our hamburger, mashed potato, string bean, cream of mushroom soup, lechoy fried onion hot dish, and our hot dish made with canned tuna and Kraft macaroni and cheese, with canned peas or canned corn, topped with potato chips crushed to dust, or shoestring potatoes, or anything crunchy and sharp enough to remind us that we still have some fight left, even in all of this cold, that we're not all, just mostly, soft. Herron says hot dish was birthed out of hardship when, quote, budget-minded farm wives needed to feed their own families as well as congregations in the basements of the first Minnesota churches. And she says that the cream of mushroom soup soon became so favored, so ubiquitous, that it became better known in early hot dish circles as Lutheran binder. Uncle finishes his hot dish, keeps breathing out. He stares at the palms of what he once called his big Minnesota mitts, at what once killed so many turkeys without additional weapon. And if he permitted himself an inhale, however cold, surely the obscenities would drown out Martin Luther, proselytizing from the great beyond. I have held many things in my hands, and I have lost them all. Somewhere beyond this town, Lake Superior roars over a record number of drowned bodies this year, and its icebergs, even the little islet ones, creak against one another in the sound of steam escaping through some thick blanket of potato product. Uncle cracks his knuckle against the casserole dish, burns himself, finally breathes in as, over his head, above the couch, the print of Matisse's goldfish, painted in 1911, shudders against the sheetrock. We imagine the goldfish are the peas, all of those poor drowned as the mushrooms with cream in their gills. Uncle mentions hanging something from every fruit tree in the yard that now in this kind of weather bears no fruit. He wants, we think at first, to remind himself of bounty, but because he's muttering through a mouthful of hot dish, we can't tell if he wants to hang a can of soup or a can of corn or the last piece of unground meat he saw years ago or the last fresh potato or his own dumb body from the boughs of the tree that once bore things named Lady and Delicious. In 1911, Minnesota abolished the death penalty. The Republican representative from Gaylord, George McKenzie, championing the abolition bill, said, "Let us bar this thing of vengeance and the Furies from the confines of our great state. Let not this harlot of judicial murder smear the pages of our history with her bloody fingers." And Uncle says, "What does blood have to do with any of this?" And we don't know if he's speaking of hot dish, or ovens failing in so many cold Lutheran basements, or of Lake Superior, which, in 1911, sensed perhaps a disruption in equilibrium and subsequently claimed more lives that year than it ever had before. Martin Luther says, "Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree." Uncle stares out the window, and the land is untilled and overgrown and undergrown and white, and there are no birds, and the goldfish on the wall breathe neither in nor out, and Uncle says, in the presence of no birds, swallowing the thick last of the amalgam, a crumb of perfectly gold tater tot holding to his bottom lip, "That's because that motherfucker never lived in motherfucking Minnesota." If there are no birds, the only song here is the steam escaping our hot dish, freezing in the air even before it can get to our window panes, blind us to the weather outside. Uncle says here blindness is another kind of protection, and we think he means a kind of warmth, another sort of blanket, until we see something coagulating in his eyes and remember that there are no rules to hot dish, that casserole is variously defined by necessity, that iris and ice have only an R to separate them, the letter that's desperate to evoke a kind of growling, but here, today, in this living room, this winter, can only groan, overfull, digesting, but still so far from warm. We think he's sleeping with his eyes open when he says, "Boy, you never think of Minnesota when you think of the Dust Bowl, but think of it now. 2 decades and no beets. All our farms, cinders in the summer, frozen cinders after. Ha, that was the rotation." So, of course, the canned, the bagged, the processed, the tubers now reduced to buds in a box, which sounds to us like some funeral for something floral, but which sounded to all of those Dust Bowl farm wives like the perfect ingredient for a basement resurrection. Uncle mutes the television, the program perpetuated by the Minnesota Historical Society. A vaudevillian brew, including this hour, yo-yo tricks with Dazzling Dave, fancy dancing with Larry Yazzie, member of the Sac and Fox tribe, and magic with Brodini. The show is newly called the Big Wow Family Variety Show, formerly known as Global Hot Dish. Historical Society executives credit the renaming to a flood of viewer letters wherein countless Minnesotans expressed that naming a variety show after the state dish was either a trivializing of their culinary cultural inheritance or setting the bar too high. The Minnesota winds blew continuously from 1934 to 1936. These winds whirled so violently that residents couldn't tell if they were coming off the lake or from the land. Approaching winter, cold snaps were so abrupt that this pulverized dirt froze in midair. The winds were so fierce that, according to some locals, especially farmers whose properties were flat, uninterrupted by building or landscape, the frozen earth blew all winter long, pelted crops and windows and faces, pocked hands. This black snow during blizzards embedded itself in the actual snow and collapsed roofs, industries. The federal government paid Minnesotans to kill their emaciated cattle, encouraged the afflicted to hang wet sheets over their homes to protect themselves from the plague. But in Minnesota, wet sheets freeze. The ice sloughs to the ground in the sort of shards with which so many Minnesotans, desperate, imaginative, dirty-mouthed, and destitute, took their lives. In this way, federal advice becomes mercy killing. In this way, we retreat to the basement and pour everything we have into our one remaining dish. We know 10,000 lakes is bullshit, an insufficient number. Here in winter, we know in these lakes, goldfish float not belly up to the sky as we'd like to believe, but sink toward the bottom, to the depths that have so far frozen incompletely. Here, the lowest of the church basements remains, if only a narrative, the last thawed out thing. We know, though in the Eastern Dakotan Sioux dialect, Minnesota means sky-tinted water, the Sioux did not mean that the water was blue. Given the weather here, Uncle says, that's obvious and is a common mistranslation. In the Santee sub-dialect, the name more accurately translates as somewhat clouded water or snow in the water. We look out the window, the trees hunched under the weight, our breath producing on the glass the sort of frost that reminds us when scraped off of the white middles of the potatoes, the soft stuff beneath the gold crust. We know because Uncle tells us, the Sioux demonstrated Minnesota to the settlers by dipping a hollowed gourd into a lake, then pouring, drop by drop, milk into the water. According to state legend, when one could no longer see to the bottoms or sides of the gourd, when the water was sufficiently unclear, the Sioux would nod to the settler, who wouldn't know what to expect when the weather finally turned, and whisper the name of our state. Here are freezing rain and snow and sleet and storms we call Alberta clippers and panhandle hooks and the tornado embedded in the blizzard, the grapple in the rime. Here a front blows us from behind. Here snowflakes cry into our ears and we can't tell if they are killing us or pleading with us. It is all we can do to swallow as if thermodynamically. Our meat and starch and canned this and frozen that to empty our bodies. To appease the black snow of Minnesota, children of superstitious parents were deployed to kill snakes. Bull snakes and fox snakes and rat snakes and racers, garter snakes and milk snakes and hog noses and smoothies. We hung their skins from rafters and clotheslines next to frozen hornets' nests and frozen blouses, tied them to bedposts and to the middles of our kitchen oil lamps, by the orange light of which we ground the last of the snake meat. In summer, the skins would blister, crisp. In winter, they would retain their moisture, often freeze. Uncle, perhaps really sleeping now, speaks of hot dish and snakes, wet heavy centers, crumbly toppings, how the weight of all things varies with the weather. Occasionally in winter, Uncle says, someone would try to hang himself with a length of snakeskin. And occasionally, the skin would be strong enough and he would succeed. Here, success is convincing ourselves that heat is enough. Failing that, the snakes overtake us. Pray, Luther said, and let God worry. Uncle, in sleep, convinces us gravity is only weather, the inevitable sinking into the baked sludge beneath, and electricity is the closing of the oven door. Listen, he says, for the hiss in the blizzard. Listen for that ultimate drop of milk. All toppings sink and become soggy. All heat dissipates and becomes the frost on the window. In this way, everything can become smaller, mute, as if televised. We look at all that white sky, all those dead beets. Let's stand naked as potatoes. The puddle for the hail become so agitated we have to leave this state, unzip the last things left on our bodies. Let's close our eyes and imagine obvious things inside of us. Blood and fire and poverty and family and something even hotter than that. Thank you. I'm told that before we announce the winners, there would be a chance for a Q&A, or should we do that? Sure. If anybody has any questions. If anyone is sufficiently inquisitive. Oh, yeah. When winter's coming, swallows in mass oftentimes fly into shallow bodies of water and let the ice overtake them, let the ice, you know, grow over their bodies. They slow down their heartbeats and their anatomical processes basically to the point of death. They cryogenically freeze themselves. And then comes spring and the melt. They'll shake the ice flakes from their feathers and live to fly another day. That excites me.
I do have questions, but you're going to be in my class tomorrow, so uh-huh. I feel like I'm just going to save it for tomorrow.
Okay.
I am interested. I do have questions.
Or you can ask me twice. I'll probably answer it better tomorrow. You'll give me a chance to sleep on it.
When I was a child, one of my dreams was to hitchhike the world.
Uh-huh.
As an adult, it's a lot less realistic. But I still want to travel. I'm still interested in traveling. Obviously, I like writing. I'm here. How do you use it? Because the world's different from when you did that. And so, you know, I guess any tips you have for someone who likes to travel and how to incorporate that into their writing?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I think it's way more far-fetched for a child to hitchhike the world than an adult. I like the six-year-old say. I was always blessed or cursed with an unrepentant wanderlust. I couldn't wait to leave home. At the time, I guess the only advice I could give as far as that goes is just be willing to do anything, occupationally speaking. And I talk to my students who want to write about this a lot. They don't want to write about this, but I talk to them about this. A lot of my grad students up at Northern Michigan University, very much expect to get teaching jobs, you know, straight out of the MFA, which is incredibly unrealistic given the nature of the market. And that's really no reason to come and do an MFA and things. Or to study writing. I mean, you write because you can't not write in a lot of ways. You write because you love it. I never expected to get a teaching job. I expected to be in restaurants my entire life and still occasionally miss it, even though it's not terribly realistic for me to like work the 19-hour shifts that I used to when I was younger. I was always happy doing anything occupationally in order to be in a place that I wanted to be in. When I was younger, place was very important to me and actually trumped the human company you know, that I surrounded myself with, like place over people. It's changed as I've gotten older, but I've engaged in so many odd jobs that, I mean, if you want to write and if you want to travel as a way to fuel your writing, if you're willing to do anything and willing to, occupationally, and then willing to engage in any living space, if you're willing to dumpster dive for mattresses and then just kind of disinfect them with cans of Febreze, you know, that you shoplifted from the dollar store, as I did, then you can get around, I guess.
Fantastic answer. Follow-up, if no one else. I was wondering, because I've actually been blessed enough to have traveled a lot already, as I'm only 25. I've been to a lot of in the continental United States. I've been to China, you know, so it's great.
Nice.
And I just never really approached my travel, because I love it, you know, but I've never approached my traveling as from a writer's perspective. So, like, I want to write about my experiences, but I'm still, like, the memories, I think you understand, so far removed. That like will be difficult, but I like to, in the moment, I guess, as a writer, how do you kind of parse your experiences into your material, I guess? I mean, just briefly, I don't know, that's kind of a loaded question.
I never did when I was traveling, actually, in the moment. I just completely surrendered to the moment and never tried to impose some sort of writerly structure on the experience. I never expected to get books out of my travels. They just sort of happened much, much later. When I travel, I keep a silly travel journal, you know? I mean, I just, you know, mundanely record the day's events. You know, names, places, things I ate, you know, types of wine I drank. I mean, it's not good writing. It's just a horrible little notebook that I keep on my nightstand. But I would find myself going back to those notebooks and trying, like, years later, and try and, like, fill out the gaps between, like, I would want to scratch and scratch and scratch at the seemingly mundane declarative sentences in there to see if I could, via, you know, both memory and maybe further research and imaginative alchemy or something, locate the inner holiness or horror or lyricism in those series of mundane facts. But that always came later. The Barolo book, when I was living in Barolo, Italy, I was working in the wine industry there. I eventually wrote a book about it, but I never expected to when I was there. Same thing with the work I did on the medical marijuana farm. Never expected to get a book out of it. All of that just came later because maybe I'm self-absorbed, but I retroactively became obsessed with my own experiences.
You use Lake Superior a lot in what I've heard so far from the Hastings book and the part from Minnesota you just read. I guess I was just wondering, what attracts you to that lake in particular, or the lakes in general?
Yeah. I overused the Mojave Desert when I wrote about California too. It's just, I mean, these are like a couple of Midwestern essays. I don't know. I grew up in Chicago. I've always had odd ties to the Midwest and the Great Lakes region. Although for many years I I did my best to sever those ties, as we all tend to do at a certain age, I think. I did leave home at 17 and bummed around for a while, you know, working a series of odd jobs, mostly in restaurants. And I think part of my obsession with the Midwest comes from the fact that I so badly, at a time in my life, wanted to distance myself from it. I remember years later when I returned to school, I took a class called Elements of Psycholinguistics from this guy, Howard McClay. He was wonderful. He was in his low 80s and still teaching. And he was this chain smoker. He would have to, I mean, you know, I think he, in like a 50-minute class or something, he booked in 2 5-minute breaks for him to go out and suck down a cigarette. And then when he was teaching, he would flick his piece of chalk as if it were a cigarette. He had this, you know, just ravaged voice like this. And I remember telling him about how I couldn't stand Illinois, where I grew up in the Midwest and so on and so forth, and the Great Lakes region. I just couldn't wait to get away from it. And he looked at me and he said, "Matt, you will go out there and you will find that you are the Midwest." And first of all, I was just like, "What does that mean, Howard?" And then secondly, I was like, no. Once I got out of the Midwest, I became increasingly obsessed with it, and its weirdness and its beauty and so on. So I guess I went out there and somehow found that the Midwest, you know, got its hooks into me, and I can't escape it. I, secretly, I'm like incredibly happy to be back here. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. I would, but I wouldn't necessarily want to as much. Yeah, maybe one more question, and then
So I'm very interested in your writing on like a stylistic level, but also because I share, as you said, being obsessed with certain experiences that I have. My question, though, is with you know, being obsessed about things and having idiosyncrasies, like, how do you kind of, you know, ignore like the self-doubt that may come about? Because if you know you're constantly writing about these things that are like really interesting to you, I guess I wonder like if you know there's ever the fear that like you know am I writing about food too much, or am I writing about Lake Superior too much, and like what do you like, how do you kind of like work through that, and like what motivates you to keep pushing, like to produce work on these topics?
I don't think I ever work through it. I think I work with it, within it. Like always cloaked in that self-doubt and fear. It's not something I take off. I think it's good. I think it's energizing in a lot of ways, especially in nonfiction or the essay. When we're writing presumably about real or quote unquote truthful things, whether it's, you know, factual or ecstatic truth or whatever a lot of folks want to call it these days. But that lack of certainty, that self-doubt, I think is important for an essayist always to keep at the core of their work. My least favorite essays are the essays that are presuming certainty. My favorite essays are uncertain and wear their narrative uncertainty on their sleeves. My favorite essays are grappling towards something, and the success of said essay oftentimes depends on the failure to actually uncover that thing toward which they only thought they were grappling, if that makes sense. And so a lot of essayists are talking, you know, today about to what degree is it the essayist's duty to just kind of reveal the essayistic mind at work right there on the page, in the essay itself, rife with all of its meanderings and digressions and so on and so forth, and all of its uncertainty. And so this is something folks are talking about. if your self-doubt actually shows up in your work, I think, and of course it needs to be contextualized and girdled and made artful. I mean, you know, I mean, our first duty, whether we're writing poetry or fiction or nonfiction, is not to the truth or anything like that, but it's to the art. Our first allegiance is to the art over fact or real self-doubt. But artful self-doubt is something that I think can and should appear in our work. The reader, in recognizing that, can grapple along with us as writers, which might be, depending on the work itself, it's all situation specific, a shortcut to generating empathy.
Thank you so much.
Should we?
Yes, you all know one thing. We've got a project. I guess let me just talk a little bit, I have 6 copies of this hefty book, a little bit about the awards and just the process here. So like I said earlier, as you all know, 6 genres, film, screenwriting / playwriting, / fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And students submitted their work anonymously. You know, cover sheets were metaphorically ripped off. They were electronic, so there was no actual ripping. It was electronic ripping, I guess. We read, faculty screened, and finalists that were then passed along to our gracious and multi-talented outside judge, Matt Frank, who read everything blind. He had no idea who any of you were or what you submitted in or anything about you, which is a fantastic opportunity, I think, to get some feedback on your work and just have it viewed by someone else. So we're going to do things a little differently tonight. So because of the number and the quality of submissions, we've got a third place winner in each category who can get one of these lovely books, The Mad Feast, and Matt has graciously agreed to sign them for you, so make sure you take advantage of him before you leave this evening. So we'll call up third place winners in each category, and then second place winners, and then first place winners, and I've got envelopes with information and all kinds of goodies. So we'll do this together. Matt wants to call names, and I'll look up stuff.
Okay, all right. I may mispronounce your names and things. If I do, forgive me. So the third place winners, third place in the film category, the winner is Amy Wagoner for The World is Beautiful. Are we going to clap? Should we clap after every? Yeah. All right. Oh, sure. This seems so wildly official.
Power.
Third, handshakes and everything. The third place for script is Erin Gray for Ivory.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Yes. I hope you all brought your Purell. Third place for fiction, Emily Ferraro for Drowning. Third place for Flash, Lauren Straley for Rude Awakening, A Resume. Yeah, congratulations. Third place in the creative nonfiction category, Stephanie Burnham for Running with a Backpack. Rock on. And the final third place winner in poetry, Juliette Givon, for you should have given them tennis. Second place. For film, Elise Conklin for I Am Tyler Mathewson. Second place for script, Catherine Buchanan for Raising Spirits. Second place, fiction, Erica Stager for Pas de Deux. I'm gonna start waving to people. Second place for Flash, Rachel Bradley for A Snack My Mother Would Be Proud Of. Standing is habit. Oh, yeah. Second place for creative nonfiction. Also Rachel Bradley for A Brief Anatomy Lesson.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Second place poetry, Courtney Gibbons for Things My Parents Owe Me. Okay, the first place winners for film, Robert Paris, These Colors Do Run. And Robert couldn't be here tonight, so there he is on the Jumbotron. First place script, the simply titled Excerpt by Kelsey Rolak. All right.
Cool. Congratulations.
Great,
thank you.
You, if you want to, yeah.
Yeah. So we have a truly historic event. I've been here 11 years, and this has never, ever, ever happened. But I will let Matt announce the remaining first place winner.
Okay. So. Once again, these were all judged blind, and the first place winner is the same in poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and flash. For the flash piece, Remedios Varo, the poetry piece, The Gulls, the creative nonfiction piece, Four Variations on the Body, and the fiction piece, Ritual, Anna Goodson.
Celebrating a really fantastic group of undergraduate writers. Let's give them all a round. We will be milling about. If you want to ask questions, there are books for sale in the back. Thanks to Diane at Everybody Reads for bringing out some books. So if you don't have your copy of The Mad Feast, go get yourself one. We will see you at our next event.
So thanks, everybody.